Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. 10 years ago, the United States was fighting insurgents in Iraq. In January of 2009, the Pennsylvania National Guard Striker Brigade was deployed to Iraq as part of the American force. WITF embedded a journalist with the outfit that summer. On today's Smart Talk, we look back to a decade ago in Iraq. Joining us is retired Colonel Mark Ferraro, former 56th Striker Brigade commander. Retired Colonel Ferraro, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
Also joining us is Major Luis Mendoza, commander of the 1st Battalion, 108th Field Artillery Regiment, 56th Striker Brigade Combat Team. Major Mendoza, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
And we're happy to be joined by Scott Detrow, former WITF reporter who was embedded in Iraq in 2009. And Scott is currently a political correspondent with NPR. Scott Detrow, good to see you this morning.
Hey, Scott.
How you doing?
Doing okay. It's good to be here.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Let me start with you, Colonel Ferraro. Let's go back to 2009. Striker Brigade was deployed to Iraq in January of 2009. Tell me a little bit about the Striker Brigade. What made the Striker Brigade unique?
So the Striker Brigade was a new formation that the Army developed around the 2001-2002 timeframe. So it was a whole new concept. It was an infantry-centric brigade centered around a medium armored vehicle with wheels, which traditionally we didn't have in the Army's inventory. And it was also centered around new technologies and new doctrine that previously weren't used before the concept of the Striker came up. So it was unique in that Pennsylvania was the only National Guard brigade to be selected to transform from a legacy brigade, mechanized brigade, to Striker.
Mm-hmm. So where were you deployed to in Iraq?
We were in... The brigade headquarters was stationed out of Taji, but we had units from Abu Ghraib all the way up through the Tarmiya Abi Achi area, which is the northwestern corner of Baghdad, the hinterlands, have you, all agricultural area away from the city. So about the size, the brigade operating area is about the size of Connecticut.
So that seems like that's much larger than probably what a lot of people know. In 2009, this was after the height of combat, if you will, in Iraq. The drawdown had started at that point. Talk about that, if you would.
So it was at the end of the surge that President Bush had ordered. We were still doing what they call full spectrum operations, in that you still had combat operations ongoing, so we were still fighting insurgents, but we were also transitioning to Iraqi authority. So Iraq was now the military, the police, and the government were taking the lead on a lot of things. And we were starting to transition into a more coach, teach, mentor, advise and assist role at that time. But we were still doing full combat operations. We were out on combat patrols. We were conducting raids, taking down high-value targets. We embedded with the Iraqi army to where I actually had soldiers go in and work in their operations center to train them on how to battle track, for example, how to clear fires. I had a National Guardsman who was a senior police officer from Arizona that we stood up a police training academy to help train their police to professionalize their police department. So it ran the gamut. You know, I was out every day talking to sheikhs. In the evenings, I was talking with Iraqi army generals and how we would shape future operations, how we would transition to them, and so forth.
High-value targets. What are high-value targets?
There were targets that we identified as we were looking at attacking criminal and insurgent networks. We had what they called LEPs, law enforcement professionals, with us, and they would assist us in developing networks, similar how the FBI takes out the mafia. And you would have link diagrams of who was the financier, who was the logistician, and we would identify those people, and we would designate them as high-value targets.
When you say that you were transitioning to Iraqi forces for Iraqi forces to provide security in Iraq, at the height of the war, when things weren't going so well in Iraq, one of the things that we heard most often is that the security forces in Iraq were not doing very well. It took them a while to, I don't want to say catch on, but maybe that's the way to put it, that they were not transitioning very well to provide security. What did you find in your experience?
To me, it was local. I had four brigades that we dealt with, three that actually went on the ground and did missions. One was more of a cadre headquarters, and it was local. So some were better than others. A lot of it depended on the leadership and how involved the leadership wanted to be. Those that had involved leadership did very well. Those that did not do well. It really centered around them accepting what they were going to do. There was a level of corruption, always was. It's embedded in their culture. Mm-hmm. So you have to learn to live with that. But our job was to focus on trying to professionalize their military and train their military to do what was right. And in some cases, there were some brigades that did fabulous jobs. We did a raid once on an old manufacturing plant. And the Iraqi battalion commander took the lead and did everything. He was just, and his battalion did a bang-up job, and we sat there and kind of honchoed what he was doing and guided him through it, and the battalion did great.
And Scott, I remember that this was one of the main themes of the stories I was doing at the time. The transition was still in its early months, and I would go out and report on these patrols, these joint operations, and sometimes it would go really well. Sometimes the soldiers and the Iraqi soldiers would be totally in sync, and other times they would go to meet up with a group of Iraqi soldiers, and they just weren't at the meetup point or didn't show up for the mission. So it was a wide range of things going well and things having a need for improvement as they tried to make that shift.
Yeah, you would think that one of the key elements would be to show up in the first place. that could lead to some success. Major Mendoza, let's go back 10 years. Your memories of that time in Iraq.
Okay, so I was definitely the battalion. I was a logistics officer for the battalion for the one-way field artillery, and our mission changed a little bit upon arriving to the Camp Taji, like Colonel Farrar talked about. Our primary mission, obviously, is field artillery, covering our soldiers in joint operations out in the ground with field artillery. At the same time, we came like a divisional asset. So not only do we cover the 5-6 brigades area operation, at the same time, we covered whatever division we were supporting of, as well as any type of coalition forces, as well as any other assistant brigade, sister brigades we had. Additionally, a second mission we picked up was the Base Defense Operations Center. Basically, what that is we had to become the eyes and ears for Camp Taji, which we were housing several thousand U.S. soldiers, coalition, as well as the Iraqi army. So that was our job to take care of and protect, basically become the police force. At the same time, that was a new mission, similar to what Colonel Farrar talked about. A lot of our specialties that our National Guardmen have that we don't realize, the civilian capacity. So, traditionally, I'm not a security guy. But at the same time, I had a small detail that I was able to provide, and I was selected to become a contracting officer. So I had to actually provide and supervise many of the contracts for base defense, which I'm not a contractor.
How many men and women were deployed with the Stryker Brigade?
It was about 4,200.
4,200?
Yes.
All from Pennsylvania?
No. The majority of them came from Pennsylvania, but we had soldiers, military intelligence soldiers from Florida. We had other units that came in, but believe it or not, we had about 250 individual reserve call-ups that came from all over the country. They left the Army, they were in the IRR, they got called up, and they joined us in our training when we were at Camp Shelby in Fort Polk. They trained with us, and then they deployed with us. Mm-hmm. And the unique thing, as Louis said, was every National Guardsman has a civilian acquired skill, not just your military skill. So when we had to improve on electrical grids, or because we did a lot of civil support missions, electrical grids, looking at infrastructure, I did a call out to the units. Who's a civil engineer? Who's an electrical engineer? I don't care if you're an infantryman, a field artilleryman, come in. You're working on this project. And what a great, tremendous asset to have that really in the active component, you don't have that. So tremendous, tremendous asset.
Scott Detrow, 10 years ago, you know, as we were planning this segment of the program, it seemed like it was, you know, just yesterday. It's hard to believe that it's 10 years. So when you think back to the 3 weeks that you were embedded with the 56th Record Brigade, what do you think about?
I think about a lot of things. I mean, first of all, I think about the fact that I even was out there covering it is probably one of the more remarkable things. I mean, it took stations like WITF don't often send reporters into war zones to do reporting. So just the fact that we were able to make that work and tell this important story is one of the things I think about. And I hadn't listened to the stories that I filed for a while, and I was listening through to them this week. And I think it just captures a moment in time where things had kind of stabilized in Iraq, but there was always like this danger lurking. And listening to these stories where soldiers are going out to go on patrol or go clear a market or just drive a convoy a couple hours and back. And by and large, things had gone well up until that point, but there was always a worry. So that I would sit through these briefings about IEDs along the route and cells that they had picked up, and just always this concern of things could go very wrong very quickly. And just the way that the soldiers I talked to processed that and thought about it, and mixed the hours and hours of downtime sitting around on the base waiting for a mission with the fact that any mission could take a turn at any moment.
Well, let's talk about that. Stryker Combat Team soldiers routinely patrolled the city as part of their duties. Now, this clip was filed by Scott Detrow on one such patrol.
To a civilian, everything out here would look odd. But to us, we've been here long enough, we know what should be here and what shouldn't be, what looks right, what doesn't look right.
Whitman's eye has sharpened since he first arrived in January.
So I'm looking right now, I see a truck there, I see some people standing around, various equipment. I mean, nothing stands out to me. Is there anything that jumps out at you here?
Like that truck we just passed back there had propane tanks in the back. That's always something you gotta worry about and keep an eye out for. That's something that could very easily be used as explosives. It's something we've had to get used to. But you always got to keep your eyes out for wires possibly hanging off from them, stuff like that.
Whitman explains the soldiers need to scan for people, too.
Rooftops, windows, anyone that looks like they could end up being aggressive, always keep an eye on them. Anyone that's working on rooftops, because they could easily hide weapons. Like I said, when we first got here, we gave out candy to everyone until we started having...
Okay, I think you heard the beginning of where we're going with this. Things can change kind of quickly, as you'll hear in this next clip.
Get out! Get out! Get out!
Sergeant Stephen Jones of Bradford McKean County had been stopping traffic in the streets so the squad could cross. But a beige SUV sped up in an attempt to drive past, triggering a direct confrontation. Jones screamed at the car to stop, which it did, less than a foot from the muzzle of a rifle trained directly at the driver's face.
The car's right there, stop! You see them! Play your games, buddy! Good way to get killed, all right?
Specialist Whitman murmured lucky during the confrontation and explains what he meant.
That guy's lucky, very lucky he didn't get shot.
The patrol carries on, and no soldiers seem fazed. Traffic starts to move again, and the din of market life returns. After walking the perimeter of a large parking lot, the squad heads back to its three-parked Stryker.
So, Scott, talking about your own personal reactions as you're watching this SUV that doesn't stop at where it's supposed to.
Yeah, I will never in my life forget that moment. I still remember all of the details. We're walking, we're having that conversation, and then all of a sudden, just in front of us, it looks like a gun is pulled up. There's a dramatic confrontation. You don't know Like the soldiers were saying, you don't know whether it's an attack or whether it's someone just trying to get on with his day and get through the roadblock. And one of the things I remember is that subconsciously, without realizing it, I'd written in all capital letters in my notebook, gun, and underlined it. I ended the story by talking to that soldier just about the experience. You know, if I could do the story 10 years later, I think it would have been impossible to do it. But I've always wondered what the man in the car thought about that, what his motivations were, what his thinking was, how he felt about having American soldiers acting as police officers, traffic cops in his hometown. I didn't get a chance to talk to him, and I don't even know if it occurred to me 10 years ago, but that's something I've thought about. And just I've thought about, like I said, the soldiers from the Stryker Brigade were always, you know, waiting for something to take a turn, always taking a risk, going out on these missions, even when they seemed really routine.
Colonel, Major, I don't know whether you remember this specific case, because you had mentioned, Major, that this happened several times while
yes,
you were in Iraq.
That is correct. Since the one-way field artillery, we were responsible for the base defense operations center, so we covered a lot of the gates, i.e. the checkpoints, and we monitored a lot of traffic coming in to the base. And there were specific rules of engagement, as well as written in English and Arabic, so that we had number of times that they did not follow the rules, and there was a threshold. There was basically a kill line, and there were numerous times that there were some Iraqi civilians, truck drivers, that they were not able to drive their next load because they did not follow those instructions specifically.
A guy like that, now as it turned out, he just went through the checkpoint, but you never know that, right?
No. You can always do what ifs, but what a lot of people don't understand is you need to have that mindset when you're out on patrol, as well as when you're actually dealing with combat operations. And if you hesitate, you may be killed or others may be killed. And trying to explain that to the common individual, a civilian, may not understand. The only person that I think or organization that could understand that type of mindset is the police force here in the United States. But when you're in that type of trick mindset and environment, you need to take care of yourself, and we need to take care of each other.
Colonel, I saw your reaction when you heard one of your soldiers say, "Buddy, that's a good way to get killed." Obviously, you know, it is a good way to get killed.
Absolutely.
When Scott described it, you know, he's a foot away from a rifle barrel.
So, you know, kind of leaning on what Lou said, we have to get it right every day, every minute of every day. They only have to be right once. In that instance, if that soldier didn't do what he did, who knows what could have happened? So it's just, you know, a lot of people will get criticized for hearing that. Hey, buddy, you know, that's not the way to talk to somebody. Well, put yourself in his shoes. You know, cars going by. We lost two soldiers in Iraq, Mark Baum and Chad Edmondson, who were great Americans, gave the ultimate sacrifice. We had 73 wounded through combat actions, whether it was direct fire incidents, indirect fire incidents, IED incidents. So it's important to understand that environment that you're in, and you just have to be aware, and you have to be right all the time, or you don't know what's going to happen.
You're listening to. Go ahead, Scott.
So I actually had a question for the colonel, if that's okay.
Yeah, sure.
You know, I'm listening back to these stories, and I was only there for a matter of weeks. And again, the incidents like that, there wasn't actually any violence. There was just the potential of violence, right? And the close calls like that. And I'm getting kind of, my pulse is going up, and I'm getting kind of nervous thinking back to that moment. And again, I was only there for a limited amount of time, and a lot of the soldiers saw and experienced much worse. And I'm wondering, 10 years out, what sort of conversations do you continue to have? What sort of support does there continue to be for soldiers kind of still dealing with PTSD from an extended deployment to Iraq like that?
So, you know, first thing, we'll talk about our KIA, because we have Gold Star families, and we have numerous of them in the state of Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania took a large hit during these wars. And we, to this day, still have outreach of to every one of those family members. The state does a tremendous job. The Adjutant General hosts events. He invites them to their house as individuals. We do group events. And there's a lot of support out there for these Gold Star families. So that's out there. And then not recently, but as a result of all the stuff that was going on with PTSD, not only do we have now mental health counselors within the National Guard, which you would not think because we're a part-time force, but the DOD has given us money to have contractors come in and have a small full-time staff that's regionally set to help soldiers with these issues. I'd be the first one to stand up and tell you I went to counseling when I got back. My wife told me, hey, go get counseling. And, you know, she's the boss. So I went. And I share that with soldiers because I think it's important for somebody, you know, I got a bird on my chest. I'm a colonel. I'm not scared to say I went to counseling. Let somebody come and call me a name. I'll punch you in the throat. but we've upped that, upped those services for our soldiers. Plus, the VA is taking a large role in providing services for our service member. We've been able to get them into those programs through veteran service officers that actually the Department of Veterans Affairs, Military and Veterans Affairs supports as well on the state side. So it's a combination of federal and state efforts being able to support those soldiers.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. You can check out some of the upcoming topics for Smart Talk at WITF.org/smarttalk. Some of the shows we're working on: research on mass shooters, the needs of Pennsylvania's children, and the health of Pennsylvania's waterways. We invite you to share your questions in advance by sending us a voice memo or leaving voicemail. See what's coming up at WITF.org/smarttalk. Today we're talking about 10 years since the 56th Striker Brigade, Pennsylvania National Guard, was deployed to Iraq. Our guest today, retired Colonel Mark Ferraro, former 56th Striker Brigade Commander, Major Luis Mendoza, Commander 1st Battalion, 108th Field Artillery Regiment, 56th Striker Brigade, and Scott Detrow, former WITF reporter who was embedded in Iraq in 2009. Of course, Scott is now a current correspondent with NPR and has been seeing the battle going on in Iowa over the last few weeks. If you have a question...
More butter than
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Scott, I want to go back to a story that you filed. It's entitled Convoy. You were on convoys. I don't know how often you were on convoys, but this was one time in particular. Let's listen to that story.
Surround our soldiers.
The company gathers for a final roll call and a quick prayer, then gets into the trucks and MRAPs, large clunky vehicles resembling supersized Humvees. I ride in the trail vehicle with Sergeant Ryan Heim of Lebanon. He's just finished telling me they haven't been attacked all year when his luck appears to change. A sparking projectile has skipped across the road just in front of the MRAP.
Roger, we had some fire from the left side and hit the southbound lane in front of these tanker trucks. Gunner heard it. We have no PID, we have no visual on anything on the left. We continued moving. Great.
It turns out to be nothing. A road flare fired by American troops traveling in the opposite direction.
Well, first of all, Scott, when I heard that report again after 10 years, my first thought is, what's that American patrol firing a road flare across the road when everyone is getting thinking that their IEDs around? But again, to talk about your observations from that mission.
Yeah, listening back to that report, I hadn't heard it probably in 10 years until I listened to it again yesterday. And that moment obviously stuck out. Never got a clear answer on who shot the flare and why. But the other thing I was thinking about is in the beginning of the report, just talking to a bunch of the soldiers as they waited to go on the mission, just about, you know, what was bothering them, what was on their minds. And it was just like a lot of everyday stuff. Like, they all hated the internet access on base. They all thought it was too slow. They were all frustrated. And I remember thinking, like, I don't know how much sympathy you'd get from like a soldier in World War II about the fact that the Skype
connection is a little slow, but I remember talking to a soldier that in that story who had missed the birth of his daughter and just the pain that he felt of having to only rely on pictures and emails and not even having a chance to meet her until he got back to the United States.
You know, when the three of you were describing that story a little bit earlier of the Iraqi that went through the checkpoint, and Major Mendoza and Colonel Ferraro talked about always having to be prepared, always having to be on guard, that you make one mistake and it could be a deadly one at that. Scott, as an observer, what did you observe the 3 weeks that you were there about the soldiers who were deployed and their mindset?
You know, I think the thing, I had been covering the ramp up to the deployment for a while at that point, so I had probably been covering on and off the National Guard and the Striker Brigade for about a year by the time I went, and I had learned a lot more about them than I had before. You know, I haven't really covered the military since then, but I think the thing I didn't fully expect, and every soldier I talked to said, oh, yeah, that's like one of the basic things about military life, is how much downtime there would be and how much time you would have to just kind of sit around and think about things. And, you know, maybe once every 2 days or so, they would go out on an extended mission, and then it would be 4 or 5 hours of very intense work, very intense mental work. And then coming back and kind of going to the off-brand Taco Bell or the off-brand Pizza Hut or whatever on the base and just kind of sitting around and being frustrated, especially given that it was that kind of lag period in 2009 of the stabilization of the surge had started to work and they were kind of handing things off to Iraq, but not fully.
Major Mendoza, you really struck me when you talked about that, when you said that one mistake, we can't afford to make a mistake if it's an insurgent who is going through a checkpoint, they only have to be right one time.
Correct.
Same question I asked Scott about his observations, but the mindset of a soldier who has to be constantly 100% prepared all the time.
Correct. So regardless of whatever mission that we were doing, like Colonel Farrar talked about, we were doing full spectrum operations. We're doing field artillery, infantry, convoy, engineering, clearing routes, checkpoints, patrols, doing training. And the biggest thing that we constantly do, even now in peacetime, is it's called rehearsals. And regardless of whatever position or rank you have, we all need to do rehearsals, and we have to go through what ifs. And understanding all the steps, especially with the rules of engagement, rules of force, our deadly force. Everybody in us must be 110%. If you're 1% have doubt, you need to ask those questions, because when you have to make that decision to pull the trigger, you need to be 100% accurate. At the same time, you know, protecting, we always teach, you need to protect your individuals to your left and your right. Your family at home, but our family is who we have to our left, to our right.
Let's take a phone call from Kathy in Newport. Kathy, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to know if there isn't something better we can do for these guys when they return home. My son-in-law came home after his second deployment with really severe PTSD, but because of the attitude of his superiors, he believed that real men didn't need help, absolutely refused to go get counseling, went one session, came back, and was told that he needed not only to see, he needed a psychiatrist and he needed medicated. And he refused because his superiors had told him real men don't need help.
Colonel Farrar, what about that?
Having a gun, he was leaving loaded guns. Yeah.
So, you know, as I said, I went. Somebody who doesn't want to call me a man, come see me. But it's something that I think over time that culture has changed, because senior leaders have identified with the fact that, yeah, it's okay. It's not a career ender anymore to say, I've been through counseling, I have a condition. You know, I would argue that she could reach out to some of our veteran BSOs that we have, veteran service officers that we have, and we can look to try to get him whatever help he needs. That's what they're there for. Mm-hmm. They're wanting to do it.
We're almost out of time for this segment of the program. I want to thank the three of you for being with us. Colonel Ferraro, looking back 10 years, what's the takeaway? What do you want Pennsylvanians listening to this program to know?
They should be proud of the men and women of the 56th Stryker Brigade and the Pennsylvania National Guard, the 20,000 soldiers and airmen and the civilians that support the Guard from DMVA every day. They do great stuff. You know, we were just one blip in time, but if you look back every day, whether it's doing domestic support operations, supporting Pennsylvania here in the Commonwealth, or overseas doing missions, you should be proud of what these men and women do because they sacrifice a lot being citizen soldiers. And also, you got to thank their families because they sacrifice a hell of a lot, too.
Scott Detrow, I kind of joked about the battles of Iowa, but looking back on those 10 years, I'm sure those 3 weeks in Iraq, one of the highlights of your career, but what do you take away from it, especially reminiscing this week?
Yeah, it was a meaningful experience. It's some of the reporting that I'm most proud of having a chance to do in my career. And I just learned a lot. And it was eye-opening. It was eye-opening to see what life is like in a war zone, to travel with these soldiers, you know, in MRAPs and helicopters and Strykers going around north of Baghdad like I did. It was just you know, I wish, you know, listening to it now, I wish I'd reported things in a little different ways. You learn a lot in the 10 years since in terms of how to go about filing stories. But I feel like all the stories we did held up. And again, the fact that WITF made the effort to cover this story and we continued to cover it after they came back, I think is something that was something I'm really glad that we did.
Scott Detrow was with WITF at the time, embedded in Iraq in 2009. He's current NPR political correspondent. Retired Colonel Mark Ferraro, former 56th Stryker Brigade commander. Major Luis Mendoza, commander, 1st Battalion, 108th Field Artillery Regiment with the 56th Stryker Brigade Combat Team. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much, and have a great day.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Listen to Smart Talk tomorrow, where we have an interview. We discuss research on mass shooters. It's eye-opening. There's not a lot of research about the shooters themselves, and we do have that from an organization that has been doing it. Actually, they have research on mass shooters going all the way back to 1966. Also, the health of Pennsylvania's waterways is a program that's coming up here in the near future. Visit WITF's website to get an outlook of the conversations we're working on. Plus, you can leave a voicemail or voice memo question for one of our upcoming programs. More information at WITF.org/smarttalk. The recent mass shootings in Ohio and Texas have renewed calls for greater attention on individuals with mental illnesses. Some Pennsylvania lawmakers say that any new gun control efforts must include an investment in mental health treatment and screening. Is mental illness a factor in mass shootings? President Trump think so.
But this is also a mental illness problem. If you look at both of these cases, this is mental illness. These are really people that are very, very seriously mentally ill.
Joining us to discuss this is Transforming Health reporter Brett Shultis. Brett, always good to have you on the program.
It's always good to be here, Scott.
And also with us, Dr. John Jack Rozelle. He's medical director with the Resolve Crisis Services and president of the American Association for Emergency Psychiatry. Dr. Rozelle, I'm glad to have you on the program today.
Oh, thanks for having me, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are @smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Brett, let me turn to you because before we bring Dr. Rozelle in, Dr. Rozelle, one of the people you talked to for this report on mental illness and mass shooters, but you talked with several people. What was the, this was right after the shootings a week and a half ago in Texas and Ohio. What were you looking for?
That's right. It was right after the shootings, and like so many other reporters, I was just looking for a way to add something meaningful to the conversation. And it just occurred to me in conversations with my editor that, you know, working on this mental health series, I've had a chance to make a lot of good connections with psychiatrists and others. So I just thought, you know, I'm just going to send out a few questions and ask them to weigh in, because it struck me as potentially problematic that mental illness was being held up as the problem here. But I didn't really have much of a hypothesis on what they were going to say, other than NAMI, which came out against it pretty
NAMI
clearly.
NAMI is
the National Association for Mental Illness. And, you know, so really people I've rarely had so many people be so on the same page when it came to their thoughts on this. And it's just for anybody who works in psychology, psychiatry, or with people who have mental illness, they see this as a real challenge every time something like this happens. Because, you know, it's important to remember that by one definition, one in four of all adults in the country will experience mental illness in their lives, and one in five of all children. So it's extraordinarily commonplace. And I think also part of what I heard from them was that there's a sort of image problem where when they say mentally ill in relationship to a mass shooter, it conjures up, you know, images of somebody like, you know, some of the mass shooters we've seen in the media who just kind of, you know, look mentally ill, or it conjures up someone with serious disorders like schizophrenia or borderline personality disorder. And so two things. Number one, most mental illness, most people with those mental illness diagnoses, you shouldn't be imagining, you know, Jared Loughner or one of the other mass shooters. You should be imagining
Loughner was Aurora, California.
He actually,
or excuse
was,
me, Colorado.
Yeah, he was a Colorado one. Yeah. I just picked him at kind of at random.
Well, and I have to say that one of the reasons when you said earlier the photograph of him that came out.
Right.
I don't know if that was his mugshot or not.
Right.
But when you looked at that,
right,
you heard many people say, all right, there's something wrong with that guy.
Right. But and totally. And that's a completely reasonable thing to think. But it's important to note that most people with a mental illness are actually people who you pass by every day, and maybe even in this building, certainly in your encounters with people throughout your work, throughout your personal life. And so to cast mental illness as the actual cause of these shootings really overlooks a lot of other things that are going on, and overlooks the problematic fact that the overwhelming vast majority of people with mental illness, virtually 99% of them, never go on to do anything.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Rizal, you were one of the people that Brett spoke to, and you were one of the people who said that mental illness, that not all of the mass shooters, that mental illness is behind the shooting. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So as Brett mentioned, the commonly conceived number is that about one in four folks in the U.S. live with a mental illness at any given point. And in fact, about half of us will meet the criteria for something at some point in our lives. But we have data. We have study after study after study that have looked at people who've been involved in mass shootings. And even though there's a lot of different methods, a lot of different definitions, one of the things that most of them seem to indicate is only about one in four of folks involved in mass shootings has any type of identifiable psychiatric illness, either current or in the past. And we also have a lot of data that looks at violence in general, because keep in mind, if we, snapped our fingers and got rid of all the mass shootings that occur, we'd still be left with probably, 98, 99% of the violence in our country. And when we look at violence in general, probably only about 5% or so of that is attributable to psychiatric illness.
When you say, okay, your violence overall, some of the shooters, though, now Brett mentioned Loughner in Colorado, but I think about Sandy Hook. That young man was, all descriptions, severely mentally ill. Unfortunately for his mother and for the children who were killed at Sandy Hook, did not get the kind of treatment that he needed. When there's a case like that, I mean, you're not saying that there are not mass shooters who are mentally ill.
So the first thing I want to say is, out of respect for the deceased, in honor of the first responders who helped the survivors, I don't use the names of the offenders.
And I try my best not to do that as well.
That's
really something that we in the media are trying very hard to do.
Yeah.
And we in the field really appreciate that, and we've certainly seen the shift. Yeah, you know what? About one in four folks who's involved in one of these high-profile atrocities has an identifiable psychiatric illness. And sometimes that illness may actually have a causative role, but it's unusual. Lots of people live with a psychiatric illness. The illness doesn't define all of their actions, and that's just as much true for a person who engages in violence as a person who goes to Starbucks and buys a coffee. The illness does not define the person. It doesn't define the behavior. Now, sometimes there's an intersection, and sometimes that intersection is really important. And as an emergency psychiatrist, we better recognize it, and we sure better get it right. But more often than not, there's not an intersection. When we look at the incident in Connecticut, there was a report from the state attorney general that said pretty clearly that, yeah, there were identified issues, likely autism spectrum issues. But in the state attorney general report, they said pretty clearly, you know, there's nothing about any of his encounters with mental health professionals that clearly was pointing towards acts of violence. We have research on people living with autism, and most of the data suggests that they're at no greater risk of engaging in violence than anybody else. One issue that does get challenging is if there is someone with autism spectrum who may be at risk for violence. Because it's often difficult to correctly recognize and work with people with the autism spectrum, our ability to effectively identify and intervene appropriately may become an issue.
Just curious, and for our audience, I'm sure has some questions as well, what are the duties, what does an emergency psychiatrist do?
Well, you know, it depends a lot on the setting. But basically, and in a lot of ways, this is the most important question when we say these people must have mental illness. And again, they don't. But if someone comes in and sits down with me this afternoon at our crisis center, and I sit and I talk with them, and they're at risk of engaging in violence, or they say they've got a plan to engage in violence, the most important question for me is, does this person have an identified, a diagnosable psychiatric illness? And this isn't just an impression of they seem sad, they seem anxious, they seem angry. But no, do they meet specific diagnostic criteria for a specific disorder? And if so, is that something that is actually amenable to treatment? Is this someone that I'd say, ah, this person needs to be admitted to the hospital or needs to stay at our crisis center, or this is a person I want to set up with outpatient treatment? Or, hey, is this a person who might meet criteria for involuntary treatment? And when we look at folks who engage in violence, when we look at folks who engage in these large-scale violent events, as best as we can tell, more often than not, they don't meet those criteria.
So one of the real challenges here is trying to identify someone ahead of time before these events occur. Now, we've heard over the last several weeks, and we hear it after every mass shooting, mm-hmm. that most of the shooters told someone ahead of time of their plans,
yes.
or at least that they people could have known. But Dr. Roesel, when you're evaluating someone, what are some of the things you look for? I mean, are there people that you've actually, when you've sat down with them, said, this guy has a potential to be a mass shooter?
Absolutely.
There is.
Yes. So, and one of the things you just identified, this idea of warnings, threats, or leakage, vital information. Most of the studies of large-scale violence and a lot of our other studies when we look at other people engaged in violence, it's not a surprise. These are not people who just snap. They build towards a specific plan of attack or a point where they're ready to attack maybe someone at random, but there's hints in advance, and sometimes it's pretty clear. Oftentimes it's quite clear. There are threats. They say, hey, you, I'm going to get you. I'm going to hurt you. Or they do what we call leakage. They say to someone else, hey, I'm going to go get so-and-so, or stay out of school, stay away from the workplace tomorrow. There's a clear indication that they're going to engage in some type of violence. And as an emergency psychiatrist, as someone who works in the field of threat assessment and threat management, that's gold, because that's our opportunity to say, hey, look, not based on something really nonspecific like, you know, their diagnosis, their religion, the color of their skin, you know, their age, something like that. Something really specific. They've made an affirmative act. They've made a statement about their intent. And now we can dig a little bit deeper. So we start with that leakage or that threat. About 60 to 80% of people who engage in these attacks have threatened or leaked the information in advance. We look for prior violence. We look at their motivations. We look at whether or not they've taken acts of preparation. Have they done research? Have they acquired weapons? Have they acquired costuming? Have they thought about those types of things? And, oh, yeah, by the way, do they have an identifiable, treatable psychiatric illness that may be playing a role or may not be playing a role? Because if we can treat that illness, maybe we can improve their judgment, improve their situation, and address those issues. And, oh, by the way, lots of stuff comes to us in emergency settings that doesn't have to do with a psychiatric illness, that doesn't have to do with a medical diagnosis, that we can still be pretty helpful with. We do a lot of stuff around helping to link people to housing, to community resources, to social supports, and sometimes those can make a real difference in someone's life and shift them from that pathway to violence towards a better pathway for themselves.
Brett,
I agree. And thanks for pushing it over to me. I think it's also worth noting that this is going on within a conversation about what do we do. Let's not lose. I don't think we are losing sight of the fact that that's ultimately a big part of the discussion here. So what concerns a lot of people who I talk to is that by shifting the focus to mental illness, you're doing two things. You're taking the focus away from other areas that might be really significant, important areas, and whether that's something like Dr. Rozelle's talking about with threat assessment and prevention, or even things like red flag laws and access to firearms, it sort of shifts the blame in some people's minds away from that. And the other thing this is doing by focusing on mental illness, and this is a sort of more like a externality or collateral damage of this, is that it's actually increasing the stigma around having a frank discussion of mental illness. And we pay the word stigma and reducing stigma a lot of lip service, but many times the very same people who are trying to do that often inadvertently are perpetuating that by treating everybody who has depression or bipolar disorder or schizophrenia as a potential mass shooter or as somebody who we need to be worried about. So I think that was just part of the conversation. And just as one final note on that, one of the most telling things in my story that perhaps didn't stand out, so I'll give it some attention now, was a county mental health administrator was asked if more funding would help. Now, this is somebody who has been calling for more funding for years because funding, by the way, has not increased in Pennsylvania in a meaningful way in years. So for all the talk about focusing on mental health, we don't really focus on mental health. At least we don't increasingly focus on it. And so even asking him, he said, well, more funding is important, but based on the data, we actually don't see how that would reduce mass shootings.
I absolutely agree with that. I would love more funding. I have lots of great ways to spend that funding, but I'm not going to pretend that it'll make a meaningful impact on violence.
We had a listener, Lynn, who, following up on what you were just saying, in my opinion, if politicians use mental health as a cause for gun violence in order to avoid losing voters who don't want any regulations on gun use and to avoid alienating the NRA. We also have a listener who says that according to the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, in 2017, men died by suicide 3.5 times more often than women. White males accounted for 69.67% of suicide deaths. Many mass shooters, although they get a lot of attention, we have a lot of more suicides out there. People killing themselves or seemingly knowing going into a situation with little plan to retreat or get out alive. Is there a connection between our overall high suicide rates for men and the seeming suicide by mass shooting? Dr. Rozelle, what do you think?
So first off, their points are well taken. Suicide accounts for about 60% of the firearm deaths in our country compared to homicides, which are a little bit less than 40%. A lot of the risk factors for violence are similar or overlapping or identical to the risk factors for suicide. Suicidal thoughts or suicidal behavior is a good risk factor for violence and vice versa. There's absolutely overlap. Some of the people who engage in violence, including large-scale violence, are also suicidal at the time. They expect to die. They want to die. They're trying to get someone else to hurt them or kill them. But these are rare and unusual cases, and oftentimes that doesn't seem to be a factor. Mm-hmm. If you're going to come up with a public health intervention that can positively impact the lives of people living with suicide risk as well as those with violence risk, absolutely. The more things we can impact, the better. And they're absolutely right to say that our much greater burden of firearm deaths in our country is suicides rather than homicides.
We only have a minute left. I want to thank both of you for being on the program today. Obviously an important issue to discuss. Is it accurate to say, Dr. Rozelle, I'll pose this to you, is it accurate to say, though, when we are talking about ways to prevent mass shootings in the future, that mental health is one aspect, maybe not the main aspect, but one aspect that we have to look at when we're trying to prevent this?
It is one element. It's an important element, but there's a lot more to it than mental health. Mm.
Brett, let me, the final word as to mental health and these mass shootings?
Well, I think to just kind of ride on what the question you asked Dr. Rozelle is that, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, I think it was either an FBI or a Secret Service
Secret
study
Service.
That showed an interplay of, I think, four or five factors. So it's certainly part of it, but it's certainly not the whole picture.
Brett Schultes, WITF's Transforming Health, third reporter, Dr. Jack Rozell, medical director with Resolve Crisis Services and president of the American Association for Emergency Psychiatry. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Check out WITF's Transforming Health online at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross.